What don't we already know about Napoleon Bonaparte, one of the most famous men in history? The British historian Andrew Roberts will join us to discuss his take on the French emperor, Napoleon, a life.
But he was also a builder, a creator. He was the man who was the founder of modern Europe in many, many ways.
What happened to a military family when it lost two sons, one to combat, the other to suicide? Yoki Driessen will be here to talk about his new book, The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War.
There were members of the Graham family who said to Mark and Carol, "Your son sinned by taking his own life. He shouldn't have a memorial service in a church. He shouldn't be buried the same way in a Christian cemetery."
Alexander Alter will join me with notes from the publishing world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Andrew Roberts joins me now. He is the author of a new biography, Napoleon, A Life. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Pamela.
Okay, why take on Napoleon? There have obviously been biographies of the man before.
There have been so many biographies that there are actually more books in existence with his name in the title than there have been days since his death. But nonetheless, I thought I had something new to say. It's been made an awful lot easier by the publication since 2004 of the 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed in his life. And so that allows us to see the extraordinary multiplicity of interests and the way in which he compartmentalized his mind and the way in which he was able to multitask.
Why did it take so long for those letters to be published?
Some of them have been published in different editions. Some of them were published back in 1853 when Napoleon III came to the throne. And others have been cropping up in auctions and various other manners since then. But what the Fondation has done, and it's a great institution based in Paris, is to bring them all together in a series of volumes for the first time.
This is the Fondation Napoleon?
Yes, it is. It's a very highly prestigious scholarly organization in Paris, which is dedicated to allowing more people to know about not just Napoleon I, but also his nephew, Napoleon III.
And we should say that you've just gotten a very nice award from them.
Well, that's very generous of you to mention. Yes, I won their Grand Prix, which is their top award, and it's for any work of literature or film or play or whatever that is about Napoleon, and they have about 15 French professors sitting on the panel, and I just won it this morning.
Congratulations. So what do the letters tell us about Napoleon that we didn't already know?
Well, first of all, this concept of his ability to compartmentalize his mind. When he was, for example, about to move his vast army at the beginning of the war of the Third Coalition right the way across Europe, he was also writing a note to Pierre Forfait, who was the prefect of Genoa, telling him not to take his mistress to the opera. And when he was in Moscow, when two-thirds of Moscow had been burned down by the Russians, he was still able to write the regulations of the Comédie Française. And there's another example where he was just about to fight the Battle of Borodino, the bloodiest battle, it turned out, until the First World War in the history of mankind. And yet he was able, the night before that, to sit down and write the rules of a girls' school that he wanted to set up in Saint-Denis. And this is very, very clear from the letters, this amazing way in which he's able to entirely shut off one part of his mind and open almost like a drawer. That was the form of words he used, almost like a drawer in his brain to look at something else.
How would you describe the current sort of dominant view of Napoleon? I mean, I think that in America we see him as, you know, a warrior, an emperor, a conqueror. Is that accurate?
Well, not really. That's not. He was all three of those things, of course. But he was also a builder, a creator. He was the man who made was the founder of modern Europe in many, many ways. And he was also somebody who had more wars declared against him than he declared on other people. He was completely responsible for the appalling opportunistic war in the Iberian Peninsula against Spain and Portugal, and of course the invasion of Russia in 1812. But the other seven wars of the coalitions were all declared against him.
Have we underestimated him as a diplomat, as a statesman?
I think so. Yes, his he was, of course, faced with this ancien regime powers of Prussia and Russia and Austria and Britain, who were pretty much opposed to him for over 20 years. And yet he managed to ensure that until right at the end, they didn't all coalesce against him at the same time. And that required a great deal of pretty intricate and impressive diplomacy and statesmanship.
I think it would be accurate to describe the biography as largely an admiring one, and yet Napoleon has not traditionally been so popular with British historians. Do you think that that's changing?
Yeah, I think it is, yes, because most of the British historians who've been writing over the last 50 or 60 years have been completely overpowered, it strikes me, by the example of 1940 to 45, and they constantly misunderstand Napoleon and see him as another prototype of Adolf Hitler, which he simply wasn't. And yet, one can understand if the Second World War was the most powerful influence on one's intellectual development, as it has been with so many of the older generation of historians, why they might see this. But I wasn't born until 18 years after the Second World War ended, so I think I'm able to see him in a much more objective light. I think you're right, by the way, when you say that overall an admiring portrait of the man, but it is in no way a hagiography. You know, I do point out that he was responsible for an appalling war crime in Jaffa in Israel in 1799, and that his Code Napoleon was a deeply sexist document, that he tried to reintroduce slavery at one point in his career, although he did abolish it later on. This is not a one-sided book by any means.
You also describe him, though, as a bona fide intellectual, and that I don't think is our popular perception of the man. Can you explain what that side
of him? Yes. Is it not? That's a shame, because I find that America has got a much more objective view of Napoleon than my own country, which he obviously attempted to invade. But, oh yes, when one looks at how he was admired by men like Hegel and Goethe, his interactions with Goethe are fascinating, and Carlyle and many of the great intellectuals of the day and later. And when one sees his letters to astronomers and his the way in which he liked to socialize with scientists and his writing about music and his theories, he's a theorist of dramatic art as well. He's a undoubtedly, he was elected as a member of the Institut de France, which you don't get if you're thick. You
know? Not for slackers.
Exactly. He was, and he very much was elected on his own merits rather than just simply because he was a general.
And quite a mathematician, too.
Yes, well, it was mathematics was his first love, really, at school, because, and you had to be good at mathematics, of course, in those days in order to be an artillery commander, because it was all about maths. And so if you ally that with a good maths brain with his feeling for topography and the way that land lay, as well as a really fine education in the various military academies and the École Militaire that he went to in Paris, you actually do have somebody who, by the time of the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789, when he was 20 years old, is really ready to take serious responsibility. And, of course, he became a general by the time he was 24.
I've heard you tell many great Napoleon stories, and a lot of them are obviously in the book. What is your favorite Napoleon story?
Yes, this is an area that, again, British historians tend not to look at terribly much, but it's clear from these 33,000 letters that he had a wonderful sense of humor, a very sort of dry, ironic wit. And so I love the story of when when the Grand Almoner of France, the Archbishop de Rouen, wrote him just before the coronation an extremely oleaginous letter sucking up to Napoleon and saying how much he wanted to have the opportunity to lay down his life for the emperor. And Napoleon just writes at the top right-hand corner of the letter, "Pay the Archbishop 12,000 francs out of the theatrical fund."
That's great. Well, there are 926 pages of such stories.
No. I've got to butt in there. Not all of them text. There's a lot of bibliography notes and index at the back there. There's only about 800 pages of text, so you're not to put anybody off.
But I'm not going to put anyone off. There are many great stories within. It is a huge, sweeping biography. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate it, Pamela. Thank you very much indeed.
The book again is Napoleon, A Life by Andrew Roberts. Alexandra Alter joins me now to talk about what's going on in the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
All right. We have sex and sordid stuff to talk about this
week. Yes, the news is very scandalous and salacious this week. Literary award season continues, but this week it's a prize that most writers don't want to get. It's the Literary Review's Bad Sex in Fiction Award, and they announced their shortlist. The Booker Prize winner Richard Flanagan made the cut, as did Michael Cunningham, Haruki Murakami, Helen Walsh, and this is a prize that's given every year for poorly written, perfunctory, or redundant passages of sexual description.
Do they offer any quotes?
Oh, they do. They really do.
And do you have a favorite?
I have to say, Richard Flanagan, his passage is very compelling. He was called out for writing a sex scene in which the act is interrupted by a dog killing a penguin, which is quite creative. So
that happens if you to everyone, though, doesn't it?
I think so. I think it's pretty common if you read Cosmo. So the passage that they cite is, "He kissed the slight rose-colored trench that remained from her knicker elastic running around her belly like the equator line circling the world. Dorigo looked up." That's the hero. "A large dog stood at the top of the dune. Above the blood-jagged drool, its slobbery mouth clutched a twitching fairy penguin." A fairy penguin is a small penguin.
Okay. It's so easy to laugh when things are taken out of context.
It is, and it's sort of unfair. In fact, you know, this prize has gotten some criticism. Last year, one of the shortlisted authors, William Nicholson, said that he was quite hurt. He said he was, you know, it was genuinely wounding to be included on the shortlist. He felt that the criticism was suggesting that he not only wrote badly, it was questioning his talent as a writer, but also questioned his understanding of sex itself. So he suggested that next year the Literary Review should give out a good sex and fiction writing award as well. They have not yet taken up that suggestion.
Deeply wounded.
Deeply
All
wounded.
Right.
So on the one hand, we have bad sex in fiction. Another sort of salacious story that emerged this week has to do with over-commercialization of fiction. There's this new trend in publishing that's been around in television and film for a long time, but we haven't seen it so much in novels or in short stories, and it's product placement. So I wrote about this ebook last week that was partly sponsored by Sweetenlow. When I first read the book, I didn't realize how much money Sweetenlow had put into it, $1.3 million about. And Sweetenlow comes up regularly. The heroine is sort of embarrassed that she likes it, and her friends make fun of her, but she defends it, and she even cites scientific studies showing that it's not bad for you. And after I wrote that story, I was expecting to get, you know, a few outrage emails from readers or people just questioning whether this was appropriate. Of course, you know, on the other hand, it is supporting fiction in some fashion. I didn't get any kind of blowback on that front, but I did get a pitch from Land Rover. They wrote to me and said, "We have a sponsored short story coming out next week. Keep your eye out for it." And it turns out it was the author William Boyd, who was paid a low six-figure sum to write an ebook that features a Land Rover in it. It's an adventure story, and he's sort of known for, you know, he wrote the last James Bond reboot, so he's certainly in the commercial vein. And he said he's always loved Land Rovers. He didn't see it, you know, as selling out at all. And he said, look, his hero is going to ride around in the desert anyway. It might as well be in a Land Rover. So that went live this week. It's available for free on Amazon and on other websites. And it's a multimedia thing with links to pictures of Land Rovers.
Attention, starving writers.
Yes. No, I mean, I think that's a good point. Some writers, like Scott Turow, was interviewed by the Associated Press about the Land Rover story, and he said, you know, I would never, ever give up any creative freedom at all to sponsor a product, and I've gotten offers like this before and turned them down. At the same time, he didn't want to condemn any writer that, you know, needed the money and needed to make a living or just saw it as a way to reach a different audience.
This podcast is sponsored by, I'm just kidding. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Yoki Driesen joins us now. He is the author of The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War, reviewed this week on the cover of the Book Review. Hi, Yoki.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So there is a family at the center of the book. Tell us about the Graham family.
The Grahams from the beginning were almost like a Norman Rockwell family. Mark, the father, and Carol, the mother, met in college, got married shortly thereafter. Mark joined the military thinking he would spend 4 years and then do something else, and he ended up spending 34. They had three children, Jeff, who was the oldest, and from the beginning wanted to follow his dad into the Army. He saw this as the highest form of public service. Kevin, the middle son, who was sensitive, the smartest of them by far, but also, even as a child, would occasionally withdraw, move by himself into a corner of the room, lock himself in his bedroom. There were things about him that always seemed a little bit off, that he was almost a little too sensitive. And Melanie, the baby sister they both protected. And they formed a bubble, and they lived very comfortably inside of it, because like most military families, they would move from the United States to Germany to Korea back to the United States, which meant they had to build new friendships wherever they went, which meant that the three siblings were extraordinarily close with themselves and also with Mark and with Carol.
How did you come across the family? You reported on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the Wall Street Journal and have written for The Atlantic. Is this a story you came across while working on a story?
In 2009, I came back from a particularly long and bloody set of embeds. And I'd made over the years military friends both from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I began to hear from them that when they came home, they felt like they were not the same people as when they had left. That they would get angry for no reason, that they couldn't sleep, that their wives and children would occasionally be scared of them. And gradually it became very clear that what they had was PTSD. I knew about it, but it was the first time I had direct exposure. A couple of them told me that they were considering suicide, and a couple of them took their own life, which was devastating to me, professionally and personally. These were people who came through the wars physically unscathed, but ultimately were casualties all the same. And when I would ask the Pentagon about people who were doing interesting work on military suicide, people who had been touched by it in some way, I kept hearing about General Mark Graham. And it seemed to my mind inconceivable that he could have a serving general lose two sons. Mark ultimately lost Kevin to suicide, and he lost Jeff to an IED in Iraq a year later. But I kept hearing this name. And I went out and spent a couple of days with them to do a piece for the Wall Street Journal. And we stayed extraordinarily close, because a lot of the issues that Mark was wrestling with were the issues the Army was wrestling with, and the things he did at Fort Carson to try to bring the suicide rates at the base he commanded, Fort Carson in Colorado, one of the biggest in the military, were later replicated across the Army. And so his personal struggle and the broader struggle seemed intertwined, and they seemed like the perfect people to write about.
And were they open to being written about? Was this a story they wanted to get out there? Did they participate in the writing of the book?
They did, and I was amazed by the degree to which they participated. I showed them the manuscript at various times, and they had the ability to request a change, but ultimately it was entirely my book. They gave me access to letters, to journals, including one that Jeff kept in Iraq, which included the last entry he began before he left on what he thought was a routine mission, and was ultimately the mission in which he lost his life. But they relived the most painful parts of their life with me again and again and again to make sure we had the proper detail, to make sure we had their thoughts correctly, their feelings correctly. And Pamela, one thing about them that I find extraordinarily brave is that they know that by doing this, there will be people who read the book and say to them, you failed as parents. You had a son with severe depression. He was leaving you all these signs and clues, and you didn't see it. You had a son who wanted to go to Iraq that you could have kept from going to Iraq. You let him go, and he died. And they know that beyond the pain of reliving this, beyond sharing these very intimate details, there will be those who judge them, and they've been willing to brave that all the same.
And they've already experienced quite a bit of judgment in the face of their two sons' deaths.
That's right. They experienced it both in the family and also in the military. After Kevin killed himself, there were members of the Graham family, very religious family, very religious Christian family, who said to Mark and Carol, your son sinned by taking his own life. He shouldn't have a memorial service in a church. He shouldn't be buried the same way in a Christian cemetery, which was extraordinarily painful because built into that was a sense of judgment at a time when they were just in profound mourning. But the bigger issue for them was the military. People would say that your son, Jeff, died a hero, which he did, no question. And his funeral was a big, big deal in Kentucky, but nobody would talk about Kevin. It was as if people wanted to erase his life because of his death. And that to them was even more painful.
People even told Kevin's mother that her family was cursed.
Yeah, people told them that they needed to have an exorcism, and Carol, at that point, having lost two sons, was so consumed by grief that she thought about it, seriously. There were people who said that there are witches in the mountains of Colorado who have cursed her family. And then there were just the everyday cruelties. You know, she'd be somewhere and hear someone refer to a person who killed themselves as a coward or as someone who was soft, and immediately she would think of Kevin, and immediately she would feel like Kevin, even if not by name, was again being judged.
Let's talk about these two young men. Who were Jeff and Kevin Graham? Let's start with Jeff.
Jeff was someone who looked so much like his father at the same age that they were spitting images, and they had very similar voices on the phone. Jeff was the more rambunctious of the two. He was a heavy drinker. He was the life of any party he went to. He had extraordinary success with women at every stage of his life. He was a diehard University of Kentucky sports fan who camped out for tickets, who in the NCAA tournament would paint over the wall of his apartment the full set of brackets so he could paint in who won. But he was somebody who was always the extrovert. He was always the one who led the party, led his family, led his friends. And Kevin was the opposite. Kevin was quiet. He was the one who was most interested in academics. When the family lived in Germany, he learned German fluently. When he was at the University of Kentucky, he got an academic scholarship. He was the best in his ROTC class because he was so studious and so committed to everything he did. He was the one that many of his friends thought, maybe he shouldn't be in the military. Maybe he should do something else. And his friends thought that he was going in because his father had gone and he didn't want to disappoint them, that he set aside his own dreams to try to fulfill theirs. With Jeff, it was the opposite. Jeff always wanted to be a soldier. He always wanted to follow his father. And most importantly, and ultimately most tragically, he always wanted to lead men into combat, to lead men in war. So they're both bound for the military. But with Jeff, it was fully enthusiastically, I want to go to war. With Kevin, it was with a bit of reluctance and a bit of his friends thinking, this isn't the right fit.
There's a startling statistic in your book that by 2012, more American soldiers were killing themselves than were dying in combat.
The rate that the military is struggling with now in the history of the military has never been seen before. For decades, the civilian rate, suicide rate, was higher than the military suicide rate. So post-2001, when the long war in Afghanistan began, and then obviously 2 years later with the start of the war in Iraq, the military suicide rate began to climb higher and higher and higher. But the military would say, it's a problem for us, but hey, civilian world, it's a bigger problem for you, which statistically was true. The civilian rate was higher, even then. 2009, when I first met Mark and Carol, was the year in which, for the first time ever, the military suicide rate became higher than the civilian suicide rate. And since then, the numbers have gotten worse. But it's worth remembering also that suicide is now the leading cause of death in the country, even ahead of car crashes in the civilian world. So in the military now has lost, by a somewhat significant margin, more soldiers to suicide than died in Afghanistan, more than 3,000 troops and counting. But in the civilian world, it's now the leading cause of death behind illness, which is staggering. We think of car crashes, we see photos, we see video of crashes on the highway, but more people kill their own lives every day in the U.S. than die in a car crash.
The book uses this, the story of this family, tells the story of this family to illustrate this larger issue of suicide and mental illness in general in the military. One of the things I found interesting is the way in which historically, you know, after World War I, when soldiers came back suffering from depression and anxiety, it was called shell shock. It was called combat fatigue after World War II, and then post-traumatic stress disorder after Vietnam. How does the military, how do we see it now? Has that changed?
It's changed in the sense that there is a recognition, begrudgingly in some places, but there is a recognition that some of these wounds that you can't see, some of these wounds that have been there forever, but that people always doubted actually existed. There's an acceptance that they're real. There's an acceptance that PTSD is a serious problem, that it can lead to incapacitating depression, that it can ultimately lead to suicide. But the problem is that you have that in the higher levels of the military. You have people at the top talking about PTSD, which is important. What you don't have are people at the top talking about it in their own lives.
Right.
You don't have generals who have gone through it say, I myself struggle with PTSD.
You found only three generals that have gone public about suffering from symptoms.
Exactly, and three total. And in the course of the book, I spoke to a half dozen who who, in talking to me, made very clear that they had PTSD. It's still such a loaded word that they didn't use the word, but when they would describe coming home and drinking or coming home unable to sleep, having nightmares, flashes of anger, it was very clearly PTSD. And the journalist in me and also the person in me said, "General, telling the story would have tremendous resonance. It would have tremendous value. Let me tell the story under your name." And exactly one of these six, only one, was willing to do that. And so we think about stigma around PTSD. We think about how loaded a term it is, how toxic a term it is, that even generals who have hit the very peak, there's no further for them to go. Even those generals are unwilling to say that they've suffered from it.
There's a story in the book about troops in one unit who left a mock hurt feelings report near a sign-up sheet for soldiers who were seeking counseling, listing reasons that they needed care. And the sheet said, "I have woman-like hormones. I am a queer. I am a little bitch. I am a crybaby. I want my mommy. All of the above." Is that a dominant sentiment among soldiers and never mind the leadership?
I wouldn't say it's a dominant sentiment, but unfortunately, I wouldn't say that it was exceedingly rare. You know, the military uses a somewhat clinical term, stigma, the idea of surrounding a person with negative impulses, the idea of saying to a soldier who needs help, "If you do this, your friends will think of you as weak, those above you will end your career." But it's a clinical term. And in the book, what I try to do is talk about what it manifests like in human terms. And in the case that you're referencing, this sign-up sheet wasn't up there for a few hours. It was up there for a few days. And there's an inherent callousness and cruelty in a sheet like that that just says outright that if you need help, you're weak, that if you need help, you're a woman, meant obviously as a slur. There are other cases. There was a case of a soldier who scrawled a suicide note on the walls of his room. The Army said, "We're going to charge you with defacing government property and not get you into help." There's a case of a soldier who needed help, and his sergeant said, "Kill yourself and save us the paperwork." So it's not that I want to say these are the majority of the cases or the majority of soldiers, but it's also not something where you have to dig very far and very wide to find examples of it.
Where does the leadership sort of stand now? How well are they handling it? Has there been any improvement during the period in which you were writing about or subsequent to writing the book?
There's been improvement, thankfully, in a couple of areas. One is that there have been small changes that are very humane. So President Obama put in place a policy in which soldiers who take their own lives can get condolence letters from the president, which had never happened before. At a lot of military bases, soldiers who kill themselves get full military funerals with the folded flag, with their names being added to memorial walls at the base. Benefits, financial benefits, are flowing to survivors of suicides, akin to the way they flow to survivors of those who died in combat. Every day the military talks about it. Every year the military has one full day devoted to training about how to recognize PTSD, how to prepare for it, how to treat it. At the top, people talk about suicide constantly, and there are hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to research it, to hire new physicians. The problem is that changing the entire culture, it won't happen until people at the top talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it won't happen until people who fail are punished for it. You know, there was the hearing a little bit over 8 months ago or so in which Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York called the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the Senate and asked each of these very senior generals, "Can you point to a case in which an officer was relieved, in that particular example, for military rape, which is also an epidemic akin to the suicide rate?" And none of them could point to an officer that they had relieved. And you're seeing that here. Until officers and enlisted personnel know that if they mess up, if they have a culture in their unit in which soldiers kill themselves, in which soldiers drink too much, in which soldiers suffer from PTSD and don't get help, until they know that they will be relieved of command if it happens, and they won't be promoted if it happens, that's the kind of change you need to have within a culture like this. And that you have not seen at all.
You cite an example that the Israeli army reduced suicides by 40% after they barred soldiers from taking their weapons home. In addition to these larger cultural shifts that have to take place, are there practical measures that the military could take that would improve their, you know, or would alleviate some of this?
There are. When you talk to people who study suicide, many of them point out that a person can be depressed for a long time and suicidal for a long time, and then there's one moment, one thing flickers, and they decide, okay, now's the moment to do it. And they look around for something with which to do it. And if they see a handgun, it's the easiest way that they can take their own life. So So if you make it harder for them to find that handgun, harder for them to use it, perhaps that moment will pass. The phrase is called means restriction. And there are things the military can do. One is to give every soldier a trigger lock, where you have to actually disable this lock to be able to fire the gun. If a person has to go through that extra step, their wife might come home, their kids might come home, their husband might come home, and they'd have a moment to rethink it and a moment to get help that they otherwise don't have. You can encourage soldiers to leave even their personal weapons in lockers at their base so that if they want to go hunting or target practice, they can get them, but they're not just lying around their house. There are things that can make it harder for a soldier to pick up a gun, because in the military, more than 90% of the suicides involve handguns. Problem is, those things aren't happening. Not every soldier is being given a trigger lock. Not every soldier is being encouraged, let alone ordered, to leave their personal weapons in a locked locker of some sort at their base. And until you make it harder for soldiers to do it, where right now it's so easy, so many soldiers have weapons at home, you won't see these numbers start to fall.
Obviously, much room for improvement. Yogi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pamela. I appreciate it.
The book, again, is The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War by Yogi Driesen, reviewed this week on the cover of the Book Review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Well, it's all about Lo and Mo this week. I mean, J. Lo, who's got a new book on the adult list, and Mo Willems, the author of the Pigeon books and Knuffle Bunny. And
it's Knuffle Bunny.
Is it Knuffle
it's
Bunny?
It's Knuffle Bunny, although there is a divide, but it is Knuffle Bunny.
I trust you. You're our former children's book editor. And, of course, the Elephant and Piggy books. And his latest is part of the Elephant and Piggy series. It's called Waiting is Not Easy, and it's number 2 on the children's picture books list this week.
Deservedly so, I would say. It is really impressive how he can continue to produce these original and exciting stories in the Elephant and Piggy series. But this one, I have to say, is my favorite.
You know, it's funny. I was a big fan of the Knuffle Bunny books and the Pigeon books. And my kids were, too, when they were young. And so I volunteered to review the first of the Elephant and Piggy books. 2 or 3 of them came out all at the same time. And I said, oh, I'd love to review them. And I was a little bit disappointed. And I read them to my kids, and my kids were disappointed. And I think the problem was they're really beginning reader books, easy reader books. And I was used to earlier than that, to books that are meant really to be read aloud to the kids. But these were books that kids can start to read to themselves. And so there's a lot of repetition and a lot of the very easy words. And in fact, they're great easy reader books. But I went on the record as not being a fan of Elephant and Piggy. And now, lo, these many years later, I've been completely won over. So there's no resisting Mo Willems. He is an unstoppable force.
And so is J-Lo.
And so is J-Lo. New at number 5 on the adult hardcover nonfiction list, Jennifer Lopez, with her first book. It's called True Love. And lest you think about Ben Affleck and Mark Anthony, she does talk about them. She talks about her you know, very famous breakups with them. She's now a single mother of twins. True Love is really talking about loving yourself first, putting yourself first. And
I've never doubted that J-Lo loved herself.
It's a very confessional book, very sincere and kind of resilient. And, you know, it's I'm a little bit of a skeptic, but as with Mo Willems, she's an unstoppable force and she wins you over. So this book, True Love, makes its debut at number 5 on the hardcover nonfiction list. There are a few other new books on the nonfiction list. Starting down at number 9, John Cleese of Monty Python fame and Fawlty Towers fame has a memoir called So Anyway. At number 8, Bill Nye, the science guy, has a book about evolution called Undeniable. And then at number 6, the former CBS investigative reporter Cheryl Atkinson has a book called Stonewalled. It's been getting a lot of attention on the right and the left. She is really just a straight-up journalist, nonpartisan, no-agenda journalist. As an investigative journalist, she's done a lot of government investigations looking at Republicans, looking at Democrats. She found that this White House, the Obama White House, has just stonewalled, as her book title says, her at every turn and journalists at every turn. And she wrote a very critical book about that that's now being celebrated on the right and denounced on the left. But she's just telling it as a journalist.
The one thing that warmly unites both sides. And fiction?
Only two new titles on the fiction list this week. Michael Connelly has the latest book in his Harry Bosch series, his Hieronymus Bosch series. It's called The Burning Room, new at number two. And down at number 14, Richard Ford continues his chronicles of Frank Bascom. That's the sports writer and Lay of the Land. Independence Day was the second book in that series. We thought he was done with that. We thought it was just a trilogy. But he has now come out with a collection of four fairly long stories devoted to Frank Bascom, all centered in the days leading up to Christmas, the days after Hurricane Sandy pretty much destroyed the Jersey coast. And that, of course, is Frank Bascom territory. The name of the book is Let Me Be Frank With You. And that is new at number 14 on the list. You may remember I interviewed Richard Ford earlier this spring at an event when Book Expo America was in town. And he told me something that surprised me. Frank Bascom's name, here is this kind of indelible figure in current American literature, Frank Bascom. It was not originally Frank Bascom. It was always Frank, but his last name used to be Slocum. And he wrote the entire first draft of The Sports Writer that way. And he really got to know his character as Frank Slocum. And he sent it to his friend and mentor, the poet Donald Hall. Donald Hall said, well, okay, great book, but you can't name him Slocum because that's the name of the main character in Joseph Heller's Something Happened. And Richard Ford said, oh, I read that book. I loved that book. You're right. You know, it never occurred to me. And so he had to come up with something new. And he really struggled for a little while until he landed on Bascom as having the, kind of the same rhythm. Like, he could live with that. And now we would never think of him as anything but Frank Bascom. I got Richard Ford to retell me that story for this week's column, but I didn't have room for it. So I think I'm going to fit it into next week's column. It's a little preview of what I'll write about next week.
Well, he continues to write about Frank Bascom, so you can continue to write about him writing about Frank Bascom. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.